For the creative power of the material world, the demiurgus, or artifact, or artificer, the builder of the material world of things. Zeus is divided into two other deities, Zeus Poseidon and Zeus Hades. Both Poseidon and Hades, the water and underworld deities, are aspects of Zeus, or belong to his order. Therefore, the Greeks tell us there was a celestial Zeus, the one sitting in the heaven with the thunderbolt. There was an aqueous or terrestrial Zeus, Poseidon, lord of the seas. And there was an infernal Zeus, Hades, keeper of the underworld. And these three were the aspects of the mundane creating power. And these three aspects give us the three objective worlds in which we exist. Zeus, therefore, in man psychologically corresponds in many ways to the rational ego. Zeus can be compared to the mind united to the ego principle, and therefore becoming the ruler of man's underworld, or the personality. Zeus is the archetypal legislator of personality, ruling the world from the personality downward, and constituting, therefore, in his three aspects, the mental, emotional, and physical attributes of man. Also, these attributes as we find them in the universe. Man being only a miniature archetypal pattern of something greater, or a miniature of a greater archetypal pattern. If we begin to study these points, we shall see that our astral theology forms a series of keywords, or keys, by means of which, through simple symbols, we can arrange all the patterns and designs of the creative processes of life. Now, if we go back to the early legends, for example, we discover that Zeus, representing the third created power, the power of the material world, was required or forced to overcome the titanic forces. Now, in Greek mythology, there was a group called the Titans. And the Titans are the ones who stole Dionysus, or Zagreus, the son of Zeus, took him out into the fields of space, killed him, boiled his body, and ate the flesh. And when this occurred, Zeus, becoming aware of the smell of the fire in which they were cooking the body of his son, turned his attention, his one eye, which, like the eye of Oton, was the eye that saw all, turned this eye upon the Titans in chaos, perceived their crime, and launched his thunderbolt upon them, in which he destroyed the 12 primordial forces. He then took the ashes of these forces, containing within these ashes the burned blood of his own son, and from these ashes formed the bodies of mankind. Therefore, man contained within himself the 12 titanic principles, and the blood of Bacchus, the blood of the atonement. For the wine of the Eucharist is the blood of Bacchus Dionysus, the god of the vine, represented usually bearing the vine or grape-wound staff surmounted by the pine cone, which of course was the symbol of the endocrine chain, with the pineal or pine cone gland at the upper end. Dionysus, therefore, becomes the blood of the god in man, and the sacraments and ceremonies relating to this are part of the Greek mystery of the Eucharist. Now, in this situation, the Titans, astrologically and astrotheologically, represent the primordial power of the 12 constellations. They were the Titans. They represented the great field of space in which a solar system is to be fashioned. The Titans, luring Dionysus out into the mystery of space, slew and devoured him, or the power of the constellations devoured the light of the sun god, the progeny, the projected sun power. The solar mystery then slew with its rays, the thunderbolts, the titanic power, and fashioned from the constellations the body of man. And we have what? The little cut-up man on the almanac front, with a fish under each foot, and a lamb over his head, and a twin on each arm, and a crab on his chest, really a most disfigured creature, but still highly symbolical. This was the old-fashioned zodiacal being, whose body was composed of the zodiac, and whose soul is derived from the blood of Dionysus, the only begotten of the creating power. We have another group of symbols rising in the legend of Castor and Pollux. We are told, for instance, in the primordial Greek myth as to be preserved for us in the Theogony of Hesiod, the great creating or creation myth, which almost everyone interested in these subjects should read Hesiod. We are told that in the beginning there was the eternal power, the eternal being, undimensioned, unlimited. And that within this power were two root principles, the Pythagorean duality in unity. And these two powers were called ether and chaos. Ether was of the nature of love, and chaos was of the nature of place, unorganized. The motion of ether upon chaos, or of love upon place, caused ether, which was eros, the principle of love, or life, or energy, moving upon the mystery of space, caused the whirling of space. Here we have the same principle with the Nordic for a mystery of the frost giants and the fire giants on the edges of the great cliff of Gnungaga, and throwing their flames and hoarfrost into the abyss. They united and fashioned out of fire and frost the whirling form of Ymir, the primordial place giant. In the Greek system, the struggle of ether against chaos caused motion. This motion ultimately became a great cyclic motion, or a curved continuum. The turning upon itself formed ultimately the great field of the world egg. In due course of time, the world egg burst open. But perhaps before we get to this, which is a very dramatic episode, we could leave you in suspense for a moment as to what is going to happen, and mention something else about the egg, which I think is very interesting. Namely, that this egg was divided into a northern and southern hemisphere, of which the northern was gold and the southern was silver. Remember the use of the egg symbolically, and the colored Easter eggs by the Druids, and still the use of the sacred egg at Easter by the Greek Orthodox Church, in which the presiding priest gives each member of the congregation an egg as the symbol of the resurrection. Now, this is an interesting thing, because the use of the egg symbol goes back to the serpent egg of Britain and the Druids and many other mysteries. But anyway, we have restored the idea now that our egg had a gold and silver hemisphere. In due course, this egg burst open, and there came forth out of the egg Phanes, the great principle of objective existence. And Phanes was a deity with five heads. And these heads resembled those of the cherub of Ezekiel, except that there was an extra head. This is not so different from the mystery of the Vedas in India, because when the light of the Vedas burst upon the world, the Vedas were said to have possessed. Now the Vedas, remember, are the Hindu law. And we are acquainted with four Vedas. Now, according to the ancient Hindus, the four Vedas form the heads of the law. But no matter when you look at these four heads, there is always a fifth head in the back that you can't see. So actually, the Vedas consisted of five works, all of which are known, the fifth being called the Black Veda, or the hidden one. Now, the fifth head of Phanes is also hidden, but it exists. And the five Vedas and the five books of the Mosaic Law are both Pentateuchs, or fivefold books. And Phanes represents the five powers of the true planets out of the seven, which we have previously mentioned. Now, Phanes, bursting forth out of the egg, became the Cosmocrator, the blazing forth of the primordial form of the universe itself. The five heads are again the five Dhyana Buddhas, which blaze forth out of Adi Buddha, the supreme basic consciousness of the world. In the case of Phanes, from this power, or from Phanes, in turn, was born Uranus, the lord of the sky, and the two hemispheres of the egg, which had been broken apart, formed the superior and the inferior worlds. And it is said in the Old Testament also that which was, though the waters which were above the heavens were divided from the waters which were beneath the heavens, or the firmaments. And the upper half was the heavenly world, and the lower half was the natural world. And out of the cleavage of these two, Phanes, or the power of creative vitality, the objective archetype, was released. Phanes became the father or creating principle of many, that is, of multitude, or of legion, the formation of living things. And they all took their archetypes from his five heads. These represented, therefore, five streams of life, which many people still represent today as the five elements of ancient alchemy: earth, fire, air, water, and azote. And the five kingdoms which we represent, or were represented in the Greeks: the mineral, plant, animal, human, and heroic. The fifth being the power of the ether, or the energy of the soul, Akasha. In the development of these legends, therefore, we have the use of elements, we have the use of signs. Four of the heads of Phanes represent the fixed signs of the zodiac, which in turn become the great cross of the fixed signs upon which the sun is crucified. They become the great seasons, and the four seasons marked by the equinoxes and solstices are the seasons of the four great sacred ceremonies distributed throughout all humanity. If then we are to assume that these things simply arose from accident, that somebody sitting down tried to figure this out, where would we get? It is, first of all, absolutely necessary for us to assume that many peoples, at different times or at the same time, but greatly separated by cultures, by interests, by attitudes, by distances, came to the same conclusions or received a similar indoctrination and were equally impressed therewith. Itself almost miraculous that all people should have agreed in accepting this, even had a great missionary system carried the news, is almost incredible, because it would have meant to uproot earlier doctrines that these people already possessed. But what were the nature of these earlier doctrines as far as we can find them? In China, the earlier doctrines behind the rise of the great system of the kings, and I don't mean rulers, I mean the books, the kings, like the Shu King, the Tao Te King. These great books, which began from the reign of the Emperor Fu He, the earliest historic emperor. We know from the legends of China that prior to this, the Chinese people venerated the stars and built their great system upon the stars. We know that when Muhammad entered Mecca and overthrew the idolatry that was there, he was attracting the ancient religion of the Near East, particularly of Arabia, Persia, and what we now call the Eastern Mediterranean. And this religion was Sabianism, the worship of the stars. We know that the earliest faiths that we have of Egypt indicate that they were preceded by an astronomical cult. We know this was true in the Valley of the Euphrates. In other words, all of our religions as we know them rose among people who had previously worshipped nature, the heavens, the earth, the seasons, and similar sidereal phenomena. When the great Arya migrations in India moved down from the Trans-Himalayan area across the Indo-Gangetic plain to occupy India as we know it today, they moved in upon the Dravidian culture which already existed there. And Max Müller says the Dravids worshipped elements, planets, and stars. So Indian culture, as we know it, arose in an environment previously controlled by star worship. How does this happen? Where was this star worship? These people were not astronomers as we know them. They did not have the equipment. They could not have known the universe as we know it today. Yet their background was the worship of heavenly bodies, elements, and things of that nature. Several groups of researchers have tried to solve the basic mystery that this presents. And we always come back to the same inevitable. Namely, that the impression of these patterns arises from the constitution of the human being himself. Therefore, within the psychic field of man, as Paracelsus so broadly hints, there must be a concept according to the number 12, the mysterious dodecahedron, or 12-faced symmetrical solid, which to Pythagoras was the symbol of the universe. This has to exist as an archetypal energy symbol within the human being, the ultimate recognition that all things that happen, happen within 12. Or within a 12-fold diffusion of potential. And that this 12-fold diffusion of potential, the eternal space has as its symbol, space equals 12. Now, how it equals 12, our own intuitive nature may not tell us. But when man thinks space, or man experiences space, he receives the instinctive impulse of 12. 12, therefore, is the absolute symbol of potential in number, and was so accepted by the Pythagoreans. Potential is that which rests forever in abscondita, or within itself, invisible, unknown, unchanging. And space, eternity, being, unconditioned, must archetypally, psychologically, be signified by 12. The motion of potential into potency, the emergence of things, causes the 12 powers to burst forth into the form of a septenary. And one of the greatest mysteries of ancient Hindu mathematics was the possibility of dividing the 7 creative gods equally into the 12 creative powers without a remainder. And that was a fine mathematical problem, and it was solved. It is possible that 7 can be distributed evenly through 12, and at the same time, neither the 12 nor the 7 fractionalized in any way. This was one of the old calculations of the Hindus. I've seen the calculation made. It can be done. But by this means, therefore, 12, eternally moving into 7, causes a septenary, no two parts of which are the same. Therefore, no one of the septenary contains the same relations of the 12 elements, nor all of them. Thus we have 7 basic potencies or powers, which are the objectifications of the 12 potentials. And this moving from the state of 12 in suspension to 7 in projection constitutes creation. Creation, therefore, emerges as a septenary. Now, the septenary in this case is mysterious for 2 reasons. And in order to understand this mystery, we must again go back to our ancient peoples. We know that they recognized 5 elements. And we know also that they recognized man as consisting of 5 parts, yet they always call him a septenary. And in order to create the septenary in the personality of man, it was necessary for the Hindu to divide the emotional nature of man into 2 parts and the mental nature, giving a septenary involving 2 forms of mind, higher and lower, and 2 forms of emotion, constructive and destructive. But this was not the original intention. This was again the blind or the subterfuge. In the creation of a solar system, according to the ancient Hindu astronomers, each of the planets has 5 bodies. And they share together the 6th and 7th bodies of the sun. Therefore, the sun, as a field of energy, surrounds the planets. And the 6th and 7th body of each planet is part of the solar body. So there are 5 distinguishable planetary bodies. And the sun then has its own 2 indivisible natures or qualities which permeate the other 5, forming again this mystery of the 5 and 2. Because the 6th and 7th bodies of planets are not individualized, but are within the 6th and 7th orbits of the solar mystery, or in the womb of the sun. They are not born. Only suns are born. Planets are embryos. Therefore, no form of life on a planet can transcend 5 levels of development without moving from a planetary to a solar focus. Thus, the 6th and 7th Buddha to come are secret. The 6th and 7th senses are secret. The 6th and 7th vowels are uncertain. Always the same symbolism. And in this, the ancients use the sun and moon as the parents of the world, the marriage of the sun and moon producing man, as symbols of these 6th and 7th bodies, which later will be clarified through the release of these perceptions after man attains the 6th and 7th level of consciousness within himself. But the fact that man must accomplish this by universalizing his own nature is indicated in Buddhism, Hinduism, and even in Christianity, for universal consciousness, cosmic consciousness, true development of illumination, or the complete perfection of the mystical experience, means that the consciousness of man moves from the 5 planetary levels which can be reached for the senses to the 6th and 7th, which belong to the sun, for the sun is the Messiah and the mystery center of the solar system, and the 6th and 7th degrees of consciousness have to transcend matter, whereas the other 5 are within the power of matter. So these calculations were made long ago. We wonder sometimes how they were made, but they were. And they have survived to influence every thought we have had since. Now some will say, and perhaps with a measure of sense of justification. Therefore, that when we explain all of this, we are only going to explain the way man thought in the first place. And we still have no way of knowing whether it's true or not. That even if man had all these conceptions, are these conceptions valid? I think the answer to that lies again in our effort to understand how these conceptions came into existence. What is validity? Is validity to be based merely upon a physical scientific approach to a subject which cannot be so approached, and for which we have no instrument of any kind? The moment we transcend the phenomenal experience of living, we are out of the sphere of science. We can go far off into space and hunt for the orbits of other planets, but we are still on the level. We are not escaping from the five zones which belong to planetary consciousness. To escape from those zones, something has to happen inside of us. We have to find the mysterious door in heaven, which John found, and proceed out of the sphere of effects into the consciousness of causes. This is your sixth and seventh mystery. And in the human being, the sixth and seventh part of his own energy field he shares with all other human beings. That is why it is possible for man to attain not only brotherhood but identity. This brotherhood cannot be attained on the lower levels, but if man has a certain experience of consciousness, he can become unified with all others of his kind, because in every species the sixth and seventh part of the septenary constitution is shared by the entire species. Thus we all move from individuality to universality as we ascend. Man seeking for these integrities, for these values, can therefore only find them by the personal experience of these causes. So this brings us to another interesting group of analogies. The ancients believed that when the law, the Torah or the Veda, or whatever you want to call it, was placed into the hands of the great messianic teachers, of which seven are of particular interest and integrity as the founders of the great religions of the world, that these powers not only fashioned the bodies and structures of these religions, but as one of the old Rosicrucian adepts, symbolized in an ancient work that he did, he represented this mystery by two interlaced triangles in the form of a six-pointed star with a dot in the center. In each case, he placed one of the planets in the center and the other six in the circumference points. And changing the center one each time, he found that with seven, he could bring all of the planets once to the center. And then he would have a circumference, and in no two cases would the circumference be exactly the same, because a different one would be in the center. This, he said, was the ancient arrangement or order of the astro-mystical theology of the ancient religious systems. In antiquity, they did not have religions as we know them today divided into four or five great name groups. Religion in those ancient times consisted in the veneration of certain deities. And many peoples, not even speaking the same languages or knowing each other at all, worshipped the same deities. But altogether, there were approximately seven of these major religious motions. Each of these religious motions, like the seven wonders of the world, had a different core point. It was moving on a different member of this septenary body. I was mentioning this not long ago when someone pointed out, but Life magazine says there are not seven or eight religions, there are only five. And they gave five. What about the other two? Well, that's an interesting point. There were more. But again, the sixth and seventh religious power has not been given strictly to religions. It has been given to all of them in common. There are two powers which they share in common. In the development, however, of a simple symbolic septenary of planets, we do have what appear to be seven, but two are luminaries in disguise. In the development of the old system, these religions each served one of these deities in a peculiar way. And each of these deities represented one of the basic aspects of consciousness. The religions, therefore, actually formed, as in the legend of Jacob's ladder, a ladder of values. For each religion was like a chakra in the great Kundali system of the meditating deity who fashioned the world. Religions, like races, were specializations of the soul powers of man, and these specializations were septenarial, so that there were seven great houses of God with certain esoteric disciplines and rites and symbols and allegories and legends peculiar to them. And these religions arose within racial structure and within national distribution. The whole thing was mathematically fitted together. Frank Higgins, Masonic writer, working about 30, 35 years ago, took the globe of the planet, and he began to study this problem of the six-pointed star with a dot in the center. And he placed this star within the interior of a globe, with the upper and lower points coinciding with the poles. He then whirled this star, so to say, within this globe, causing the other four points of the six-pointed star to make lines around the globe at the points where they actually touched the surface, the inner surface of the globe. And he considered these points degrees of latitude. He then went on and continued his studies by dropping lines from various parts of the earth to the core and to the opposite side, always keeping the original form of the six-pointed star. As a result of that, he came up with a very interesting discovery, that the great religious centers of the world all fall geographically almost exactly on the spots indicated by this division and this placing of the six-pointed star within the globe. In other words, if you drop a line from one of the great centers, like the Great Pyramid, right straight through the earth, you go through another center, world famous as a religious institution. You go through these systems, and he made a very careful study of it and came to some extraordinary conclusions, that the entire distribution of man's worship has been mathematically correct in terms of the earth on which he lived, which is not remarkable when we realize that whoever built the pyramid not less than 4,000 years B.C. was able to orient that building at that time to the 11th decimal point. We could hardly do it today without a great deal of calculation. Anyone who could do that must have had a profound knowledge of something, particularly of the art of construction and building and of mathematics and astronomy. So these people had some basic concept of these things. Now the old peoples, the wise peoples of long ago, have another answer to this problem. Namely, that in a very remote time, say the Hindus, there descended upon this earth the rishis, or the great ones, that they were the immortal sages, that they had grown up and become wise and perfect in ages of culture and civilization long before the creation of man, or perhaps even the creation of the solar system. that they were the products of great previous evolutionary cycles, and that they were the ones who placed these first findings at the disposal of man. Therefore, that man did not discover them. He was given them. And that gradually these ancient ones departed and left man to the continuance of the knowledge which they had bestowed. That is an ancient Indian belief, East Indian. There is also the story that the ones responsible for these achievements of man were essentially the lunar ancestors, or the Petries, and that they belonged to the previous cycle of life prior to the creation of the earth, which was while the moon was a live world, and that from these distant and remarkable sources this knowledge came. We say this is legend, but we are still confronted with the problem of how were these things discovered. And why is it that with thousands of years of work we have been unable to disprove them with all that we claim to know? And that step by step, as we move forward, we go back to Plato, back to Pythagoras, and back to these ancient calculations. We have our choices. We can psychologically say that these ancient ones, the rishis and the sages, represent the potential of our own superconscious. We can say that before man developed his own sensory institution, which we call personal consciousness, while man was still without an objective integration such as we know, that he was still not ignorant, because the preconscious, or that which came before the objectification of his present intellect, contained so much more than his present consciousness is capable of estimating. Man's consciousness, like the little nursery rhyme, sort of came out of the everywhere into the here, and it knew much more when it was everywhere than it does now. Therefore, that man's superconscious or preconscious state was one of extraordinary intuitive awareness, and that the so-called rishis, the ancestors, the ancient teachers, were really his own superconscious parts. And that while he was still without intensive physical integration, these internal resources were available to him. He could consciously know inwardly, because what the Tibetan calls the eye of the Dhamma had not closed. We had not locked inner vision. Now, assuming psychologically for a moment the possibility of this line of thinking, let's see what has since happened. For the last several thousand years, man has gradually been developing a colossal neurosis. And this neurosis, as anyone realizes who thinks about it, is an abnormal situation arising from false thinking, false standards of value, and misuse of energy. All these things together add up to make the trouble. This neurosis places man under such a pressure of objective intellectualism that he can't even keep quiet. His mind has become a tumbling ground for whimsies. He is full of notions and opinions and very few actual dynamic facts. Let us assume, therefore, that this great objectification of man, in which his internal moved outward to meet the pressure of environment, has developed a kind of mask, a persona, in which he has built a wall of defense around himself. And behind this wall, he has passed into a state of intensive frustration and neurosis. Thus, by degrees, the very faculties which should have saved him, should have assisted him to master the world, have turned upon him and destroyed him by their own false use. As a consequence, he is now restricted almost completely to a traditional descent of knowledge passed on from one person to another, or to a series of scientific discoveries which can never escape the three dimensions. He has lost this power of knowing the ancestor, of communing with the rishis or the saints. He cannot talk with the gods. He is not of that race in which the gods, as mentioned in Genesis, walked in the garden in the cool of the evening. The trouble is, the evening now of man is not cool. It is a tempestuous world in which subtle things have very little possibility of expression. It might well then be assumed as possible that man, locking himself in an intellectual complex, which is very deep, very sound, very terrible in its implications, has simply locked the inner power to know. Therefore, that he can no longer conceive of how anyone else had it open or was able to know, but that from man's own preconscious, which is man's link with the universe, man intuitively knew, because he was able to name and recognize the facts of things, which we can no longer do. So we have several choices now. Either that man, in his ingenuity, was able to make these objective analogies and disseminate them in one way or another throughout the world. And that man, perhaps having a kind of mind not so different from the mind of any other man, that all men might have come to the same conclusions even though they had no contact. And that in a certain degree of the rise of a culture, its people always come to identical findings. This is true in principle, but there is one definite drawback to this particular concept. And that is that while individuals do come to the same basic ideas, we have another testimony that we can't overlook, and that is that they gave the same names to those ideas. And this brings it a little too close to a coincidence for pleasure. We cannot assume that man, by this method of common learning or common induction, would come to such absolute detailed similarity. You might come to the same general idea, but he would clothe it differently. Now, there's another point in connection with that. We know that mythology has been clothed differently because of longitude and latitude, and that peoples with different religions and in different lands and in different distributions of climate have used different symbols for their religions throughout history. Therefore, if they lived as the Nordic people did in a very severe climate, their doctrines took on the severity of that country, whereas those living in tropical or temperate zones had much less stress in their ancient religious symbols and legends. Yet regardless of zone, regardless of climate, regardless of all other factors, the beliefs of these principal cosmological factors were never changed or modified by climate or anything else. Also, there is a very interesting situation in which the astronomical phenomena of the Earth, seen from different points, differs. And yet, the symbolism which has developed by these different people is the same and has not been deflected by these historical, astronomical, sidereal differences. So we have to go even deeper than this to find the answer. And the only answer that we seem to be able to locate is that man's solar system is a cell, it is a structure, it is a witness to law. That the ancient analogies of the Hermetic doctrine were basically correct. That man can understand the solar system because he is one. And that the solar system can be experienced by human consciousness because man's consciousness is a miniature of it. And therefore, that man has within his own awareness that which is analogous to everything outside of himself. Thus, through the study of his own nature, He can come to grasp the laws by means of which universal motions and energies are maintained. Thus he can experience a structure vaster than himself, because the pattern is identical. The difference is quantitative, but the qualitative factor is the same. And Pythagoras pointed out in his mathematical studies that when quantities differ sufficiently, we suspect the difference of qualities. But this is not true. But that quantitative differences obscure qualitative identities. But actually, qualitative identity always exists. Thus, man, by extrasensory perception, as we call it today, or by intuitive knowledge, possessed prior to the obscuration of consciousness by sensory development, might have been able to archetypally know all things and name them according to their true natures. Then when he finally went to sleep in objectivity, these subjective things passed backward into a kind of dream state. Then your religious mysteries and your great mystical institutions and your ancient ceremonial rites came into existence, and they were rites of dreams. They were created to artificially force man away from the objective focal awareness to which he had become addicted. The ancient priesthoods worked with trances. They even used narcotic drugs. As the American Indian mystic did, they used fumigations, and a very common device among ancient people, fasting, by means of which the sugar content in the brain was reduced, causing the tendency to psychic phenomena. But all of these things that were done, like the reveries of the psychological analysis, were disciplined efforts set up by religion and philosophy to release the preconscious state of man's knowing through initiation, through ceremonies and rites, so that man could again attain the availability of the true knowing locked behind false knowing. If such could be conceived to be the case, I think we would then understand this archetypal system and recognize that our so-called astral theology is simply a shorthand system, a system of symbols, by means of which the individual, by using symbols for ideas, can mathematically and geometrically restore the basic formulas of existence. And he has worn these formulas beyond mathematics by bestowing upon them not only number, but moral, emotional, mental, and ethical dimension, conveniently doing this by creating divine beings to symbolize number. These beings are gods in the Greek and other pantheons, the great orders of divinities of ancient worship, which are actually symbols of living mathematical focal points, endowed with the qualities of those points as well as the quantity or mathematical distribution of pattern, on the basis that the ancients maintained, namely that every mathematical formula was also a moral structure, a living thing, not merely a dead pattern. All this type of thinking might give us a clue to the archetypal astronomy and how it has affected our religions, and why it cannot apparently be removed from religion, and how religion has continued to build on it even though it has ignored it, and continues to preserve it even though it might preach against it. And so denying these things in many instances, religious and philosophical systems continue to use them, never for a moment intending to stop using them, because the pattern, the circumstance, requires this formula. although we do not like to acknowledge where it came from. So out of these considerations, perhaps, we'll get ourselves ready for some more heavy weather next week.